Welcome to the Global Marketing Show, the podcast for all things international business. I'm your host, Wendy Pease, president of Rapport International and a translation expert. Come along with me today as we talk to an expert in the global marketing world about facing their biggest fears, hearing about mistakes they made or saw, discussing best practices, and sharing fun travel language and culture stories. Well, hello, everybody. Thanks for joining us on the Global Marketing Show today. We're privileged to have Leif Bailey of Wenger Manufacturing. Now, his company is really interesting. They make high-end equipment that fills your cereal boxes and a lot of other kind of boxes. So we're going to talk to him about what they do and also their journey because they do sell globally. So welcome, Leif.
It's a pleasure to be here. Appreciate the opportunity.
Oh, I've been looking forward to this. So you've got a lot of wonderful experience. So tell us, what countries are you actually selling in now?
Actually, the easiest way to explain it would be to say that we are selling actively in every country that the U.S. State Department will allow us. So really globally, everywhere right now, areas that are particularly active would be Southeast Asia. India, of course, remains a very active country for us. Brazil and the rest of that Mercosur trading bloc is always a good market for us. Mexico, continental Europe, Scandinavia, Egypt. Pretty much everywhere.
Oh my gosh, you're going to have some fantastic stories for us. So you're the third generation leader of Wenger.
Correct. Yep. Right. Actually, so, part of the third generation. I've got two cousins that are also in the business.
Okay. And so which generation took the company global?
Actually, that happened in the early 50s. So the founding generation, my grandfather was still active and present for that. To be honest, international was not something that he really felt comfortable doing, I think. Probably is the best way to say that. And just through some mutual networking in Kansas City, which Kansas City is roughly 90 miles southeast of Sabetha, we began working with a gentleman who had an import-export business, and we did some purchasing of European motors and things like that, and he helped us import those. And as we got to know him, as my grandfather and his brother, co-founders, got to know him, this gentleman, his name was Oak Smith. He was really a dynamo in Kansas City as far as a businessman goes. He began talking to those two brothers about the possibilities of export, and they began very carefully, cautiously. The first export was to Venezuela, of all places, in I think 1952 or 1953, and it was equipment for the feed milling industry, and that really kicked things off. And it wasn't too long before that gentleman, Oak Smith, decided to form a new company called Wenger International, and he really took over all of the international business for us, the sales and things like that, and helped us get all that started.
Wow, so that's fascinating. So it really was somebody who understood international business that encouraged your grandfather and his brother.
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, so now that was Wenger International. So where does that fit in the company now?
Years ago, we acquired that company and folded that international sales into our own operation. That was probably 40 or 50 years ago at this point. And so it just became part of our global operations. It was one of those situations where Wenger International is a separate business. Really, the only partner that they had was Wenger Manufacturing in Sabetha. So it was an exclusive two-way relationship. They went on to establish some of the foreign offices. Antwerp, Belgium, Taichung City, Taiwan were the first ones. Those were established in the early 80s, maybe even late 70s. I've kind of forgotten now. And we acquired Winger International not long after that. So, and then Oak Smith at that point in time was already ready to retire. So that was part of that transition.
Okay. And so talk to me about where, how you came into the company and what your involvement in international, like what was your growth of the company and your exposure to international?
I worked in the company in high school during a few summers, and then worked while I was in college over the summer, and joined pretty much straight out of university, and started in our technical research facility. That's a facility where we have installed our own equipment, and it's a place where really the entire global industry can come and see our equipment in operation, test run products. We develop some of the products that are common on the market today, and then we basically take those to our clients and say, here's something else you can make with your Winger extrusion system. So that Winger Technical Center is just a good place to start to get access to interacting with the market. It's a funny little story. So Sabetha, Kansas, where we're located, is a town of 2,500 people. And we are not the only, or actually not the biggest employer in Sabetha. Sabetha is a very industrial little community. And I used to know the number of manufacturing jobs. I would say we're probably pushing 1,000 manufacturing jobs in the community, manufacturing related. So very industrial. Many of those businesses actually got their start or were employees of Winger and either wanted to do their own business. And we encouraged many of those to get started. All of those were happy spinoffs and relationships. And the funny thing about Winger and Sabetha in particular is it's a very rural, very ag-focused community. So, you know, people on the coast, when they think of a small rural town, they really think of Sabetha. It's trucks, pickup trucks, and farmers and ranchers and all of those good things that you associate with rural America. The interesting thing, though, is Sabetha has probably at least three times a week, pre-COVID, admittedly, three or four times a week, there were people from all over the world visiting Sabetha.
Wow.
So it's nothing for the farmers, you know, to be sitting there at 6:30 in the morning having coffee, and somebody from Winger or one of the other companies in town would bring in the guest for the day, and they'd be from Japan or Germany or Thailand, Myanmar, just all of those things. And it's just something that Sabetha is so used to. And Sabetha is very warm and inviting. You know, the farmers will go up and ask the people from Japan, you know, not knowing that they're from Japan, but they'll go up and ask where they're from and have conversations. So it's really strange, really blessed mix of cultures, really every day, every week in Sabetha.
And it sounds like Winger is really the driving force behind bringing all this international exposure to Sabetha.
Yeah, it certainly started that way. You know, there's two other companies I can think of. One's probably equal in size to Winger. The other one's really a small, probably a 50-person operation that, with some of our encouragement and assistance, began exporting their ag products, their ag machinery, to Brazil. And now, a few years later, they're actually getting ready to open a Brazilian location. And I always joke that people in the area look at Winger, look at the Winger family, and say, good grief, if those guys can do it, we can surely do it. You know, we're not, we are very blessed, but we're not unique. It's just, for us, we've always known that it's a matter of just encouraging people to take some steps, to try it out, seek professional help, of course, wherever they can, and just go, just try it, be willing to make mistakes.
So here you are, you grow up in the middle of America with, you know, farmers all around you, and you start working in this manufacturing company, and all of a sudden, it's not like you're in New York or Boston where you're exposed to a bunch of different cultures and learn to relate to different people. How did you acquire the skills to be able to work cross-culture and cross-border?
That's an incredibly difficult question. I'm not sure that it was anything other than constant exposure and encouragement. So I, Sabetha, 2,500 people, is far too cosmopolitan for us. So I grew up in the countryside, and I live in the general area now, my wife and our children. And so I had kind of a dichotomy going on. On one hand, living in the country, we have horses and cattle, still do. And one minute I'd be riding a horse, and then the next minute, a friend of my father's would drive out with a bunch of people. And I remember vividly a bunch of people from Japan coming, and they wanted to ride horses, and they wanted to shoot a six gun, and they wanted to wear cowboy hats and wear spurs. And, you know, I was in middle school when that started to happen. So I don't know that it was ever intentional, learning how to interact with those people. It's what I always knew. And it's what kids that I grew up with knew, because their parents worked at Winger or one of the other operations. And it's just a really, really strange mix that we've got here. It is, we deal with the largest, absolute largest multinationals, and the senior executives of those groups come to Sabetha, Kansas, and they think it's a treat. You know, it's a funny situation. So it's really, I think early on, even before joining the company, I knew that somehow that relationship, that counterbalance of global business in a really a rural village, 2,500 doesn't even count as a small town for most of America. And just the camaraderie and the work ethic and all of those things, that really is part of our secret sauce, if you will. And it's something that we've intentionally, probably more under my belief and my guidance, we've really fostered that through these last years. You know, when I joined the company in 89, we were 20 million in sales. And today we're north of 150 million. And probably, it fluctuates, of course, year to year, but probably on average, at least 70-75% of that is export.
Okay, so how did you do that? How did you grow up from 20 million to 150 with all these countries all over the place? Like, what? How did you go about thinking, I want to, and did you think, I'm going to grow this through international sales? Or did you say, you know, I just want to grow, and it could have been U.S. or anywhere?
It could have been U.S. or anywhere. So what we really focus on, we manufacture equipment. And just for some context, when we sell equipment for either a pet food factory or breakfast cereal or salmon feed, vegetable proteins, you know, whatever we're selling for, usually most of our systems are multiple components, multiple pieces of equipment. And a typical order for us today is probably $2 million and consumes 6 to 10 shipping containers. So this is large, large equipment, industrial cooking equipment. And while that's what we manufacture, what we really focus on is the innovation. So innovation not only in the hardware or the equipment, but also in what can be made with that equipment. So that's really, again, where the Winger Technical Center stands out, in that we are constantly developing new products, things that you go to the store and buy for yourself, for your pet, if you have a pet or two.
We have the COVID zoo here. We already have a dog. So here's a little, we're supporting the use of your equipment. We already had a dog. During COVID, my son went out and acquired, he's 17, he's a junior in high school, a hamster, a bunny, a snake, three mice, and two aquariums full of fish.
Oh my word.
Absolutely. We're supporting your equipment.
Well, thank you. Yeah, so this this COVID in many ways has been a good market for us. But back to kind of the original question of was it intentional? Yes, it was intentional. And we really focused on what our strengths, our particular strengths are, which again is the innovation. It's the customer relationship. You know, a lot of people say that you've got to focus on the customer and their needs and all that. And when we do, of course, but we really like to focus on the personal relationship. We do like to get to know them. We love, especially in meeting new customers. I think I am most comfortable in this area. Of course, everything that you always read and are told is to stay away from two or three topics: politics, religion, and I don't remember what the third topic is.
We all know what that is.
Okay, that's right. And I think we've always taken the approach that, of course, we're not going to lead with those things, but we enjoy having those conversations. I enjoy sitting down with people of other faiths and not having a debate, but just help me understand, what is it that attracts you? You know, what are your questions? And we really try, because we genuinely enjoy people and getting to know these people from all over the world, that we really like to have those personal conversations.
Can you share with me a story about one of them that is extremely memorable or changed your opinion on something? Or
One that pops into my head is dinner in Margues, France, with our largest single customer, which is a big multinational in the food and pet food area. You know, in France, is Europe as a whole is very secular. And this group, we've worked with them for a number of years, and it's always been very professional. And we've had many meals together that were very professional. And I thought, you know, good grief, we're in this wonderful little cozy French restaurant. We're having some good wine, and the food is exceptional, and I'm just enjoying it. And we just start having conversations. You know, I ask about their children. Are they married? Do they, you know, what are your hobbies? And one thing leads to another. And very quickly, we got in on the topic of religion. And I was actually shocked. And for me, it was a lesson, how of the probably five from the client and three of us from Winger, I was actually taken aback by how deeply rooted several of them, not all of them, but several of them deeply rooted in their faith. Now, they weren't at that table, they weren't all Christians, but we had a wonderful conversation just amongst us all, and it was never combative. It was mutual learning. You know, why do you think that way? And we all realize that we usually think the way we do because of our upbringing, or, you know, what our exposure was. So, you know, that dinner, gosh, that went on for hours, and we just had a wonderful time. And actually, one of those people I got a very heartwarming email from them this morning, just based on some, you know, life things going on. And it's a guy that I haven't talked to for probably 6 months. But he heard through the industry, through, you know, mutual connections, of some things going on, and sent me a very warm, very, heartfelt, very faith-based message this morning. And, you know, I think I would, and most people would take an exchange like that over a pay raise or a great job review. That to me was just the connection. And I think we can look back. I hope all of us, those even listening, can look back on your career and see those times that just stood out. You know, there's a half dozen of those, you know, that just pop into my head through 30-year career at Winger.
Yeah, that's wonderful. And what's striking me is so much of your conversation on business across borders and cultures is just that individual connection. The Japanese visitors wanting to come out and ride horses and experience your culture, you being in France and wanting to understand them. So that's where that success comes in, is people are people and they want to connect emotionally. Well, and yeah,
absolutely. This probably is not something that should be said too loudly, but honestly, I genuinely believe this, again, after 30 plus years in this interaction. I think the biggest threat to world peace is politicians. For example, so we've been exporting since the 50s, and I made the trite little comment that we're everywhere the State Department will allow us. Well, actually, in the 70s, we were very active in Syria, very active in Iran, and of course, we do global trade shows, so we will see people actually. Every once in a while, we run into people from those companies that we sold at those trade shows. And we at Winger, those of us who travel internationally and do these trade shows, you know, if somebody would ask me who is the warmest, what's the warmest culture that you've interacted with at a trade show? Iranians. People who we dealt with, and some of it, again, is a bond because they remember Elmer Osterhaus, who was a service technician who traveled from little podunk rural Kansas to Iran in the 70s to install and operate equipment. And we sit there at a trade show and we both lament that our governments won't allow business. And we have great conversations, and, you know, I've not dealt with them negotiation-wise. I'm sure they're good negotiators. But, you know, they've always been very friendly. Syrians the same. So I think...
That's so wonderful to hear, because I think here in the U.S. you go, Iran, you get so judgmental when you don't run into the individuals. So here you are talking about countries that so many people think are dangerous, and you're really set. It doesn't come down to who you voted for president. It's just, hey, let's get to know individuals.
Yeah, absolutely. So that's an unfortunate part of the business political relationship. Okay. I'm, of course, a dyed-in-the-wool capitalist. I believe that's the best system for humanity, based on trade, fair trade, equal trade. And I think the political powers have messed that up.
And that's what strikes me, is less than 1% or less than 1 or less than 5, whatever it is. It's the small number of companies in the U.S. actually export. And I look at just the advantages you can get. I mean, what advantages do you have? Rather than me citing statistics, why don't you tell me, what are the advantages you get from doing global trade?
If it wasn't for global trade, I'm not sure that we would still be in business, quite honestly, because again, this equipment that we manufacture, stainless steel and sheet metal and all that, lasts for decades. case in point, the Iranians or the Syrians. The Syrians, I don't know if they're still in business, honestly, but we sold that equipment in 1972, let's say, and they're still operating that equipment. So this equipment has longevity. Of course, it has replacement parts and maintenance and all that, but it lasts for decades, sometimes generations. And if it wasn't for export, we would have saturated the U.S. market decades ago, probably in the 70s even. Mm-hmm. And so we would just be a tiny little shell. So for us, and I suspect for many small companies like us, we would be considered a small mid-cap, especially in manufacturing. If you're not exporting, I would say you're probably dying.
So what recommendations would you give to small, because you're a larger company compared to small, yeah, you know, some smaller manufacturers that could go out, because we work with clients that are much smaller and they're still doing international trade. But it's very interesting to me to see a lot of manufacturers either saying, well, there's plenty of business in the United States that I haven't tapped mm-hmm. into, or they've got some deep-seated fear about going international and don't know how to get started. What would you recommend to those manufacturers?
I would recommend that they get started. There will be a day when they need those revenues from export, they need those projects. It's hard to think of a market niche today that doesn't have multiple competitors, especially in the U.S. And many of those competitors are global based, looking at the U.S. as a prime market. So I think it's, I say this respectfully, but I think it may be a little short-sighted if people are content with only the domestic market. And as far as those that are fearful, I would say, number one, get involved with some trade associations, build some relationships with people who are successfully exporting, take some encouragement from them, ask for resources, you know, freight forwarders, XM people, translation people, get to know your State Department of Commerce and their export division. There's tons of help. Very qualified, very expert help available to lead you through the process. Most of the time, it's pride that gets in people's way of asking for help.
So that, I think that's fantastic advice, because there is even step grants for companies to go out and get free money to update their website and then provide translation on it, which automatically reaches out. So you mentioned translators. We got to dig into the language issue. So you're doing business all over the world. You had a long dinner in France with people, I assume, who speak French, and you were conversing in English.
Yeah.
Because you're doing business all over the world and you can't know all the languages. How are you handling the language issues?
Today, I would say we probably don't handle it as well as we should. To be honest, we are still, other than our international branches, we are still English dominant. Very rarely, other than the manuals, the safety manuals, operation manuals, those typically we do get translated into the local language. But English is the language of our commerce in specific. And in a few countries, for example, Myanmar keeps coming to mind because it seems to be opening up to our style of equipment. Most often what we will do is we will use our existing network. And typically when we go into a new country, most typically today, we are following one of our multinational customers that are, of course, expanding quickly. So many times they will pull us in, and in business meetings, what we see happen most often today is one of our multinationals will be interested in either doing a joint venture or an acquisition of a local company, a local food company or local feed company. So our multinational will actually pull us in. We'll sit down in a three-way conversation and our client will often translate into the local language. You know, established countries, Korea, Thailand, those are developed, and I don't mean developed economically or socially, I mean developed business relationship with Winger enough that most of the clients, if not all the clients that we're dealing with, at their top rungs of their own management, they have people very, very fluent in English. And so.
Okay. So at the top level where you're negotiating, because you're a high-end product, you can speak English.
Yeah.
And then how did you decide to translate your safety manuals?
Most of that was, again, just part of the relationship that we like to have. We like to be a good valued partner. And we know that at the floor level, the factory floor of our client, the equipment operators, things like that, most typically are not English trained, often aren't English speakers at all. So if we want the customer to be successful, then we need to do everything we can. So we started translating safety manuals and operations manuals and things like that, really from the very beginning. And then certainly things like CE requirements in Europe legally forced that, but we were already doing it, so it wasn't a burden for us. It was a burden for some others that were exporting at the time and just simply weren't maybe taking that next level step of interpersonal relationship and trying to ensure the customer's success. For us, it's vital because probably 60-65%, maybe even a little bit more, of our customers are repeat business. So we're very reliant on customers growing and expanding. Customer adds a second line to their factory. They build a new factory in a new region. We want to be their preferred partner. So maintaining that constant relationship is something that we've always taken very seriously.
So what about legal contracts?
Yep. Just did one this morning. We deal with a lot of confidentiality because we are dealing with often our customers' specific formulations on how they make a particular product. Mm. So, and just with our dominant position in the industry, we're dealing with really all of the major multinationals. So our customers are head-to-head competitors. So we deal with strict confidentiality. I probably review probably a half dozen or more confidentiality agreements per week. And I would say predominantly, internationally, most of those are still in English. But the one this morning, Brazil, it was a side-by-side, you know, Portuguese column and an English column. And we execute both sides, and I trust the Portuguese side reflects what the English side says, and it does. I can only think of maybe one or two experiences in 30 years where somebody tried to pull a fast one. So, again, people around the globe typically are just like we are. They value honesty, and so, you know, if there's an English version, we'll sign it. If there's not an English version, and occasionally we get a customer that would demand that the agreement be in their language, of course, then we send it out for translation to verify and all of that. So,
yeah, okay. So that's real. So sometimes you get the translation and sometimes they'll provide it to you.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then on the legal contract, one thing we often recommend that people add in if there's ever any discrepancy between legal mm-hmm. contracts, because it might not even be bad translation. It could just be a difference in the law interpretation.
Yeah.
That you say which language will prevail.
Right.
That pretty common statement in yours.
Yeah. Yes, absolutely. It was in the one this morning. And most of the time, since we are a vendor, you know, if the client insists, Of course, in this case, it's going to be interpreted by Portuguese law. That's just the nature of doing business internationally. And with our placement and exposure today, you know, we have a wholly owned facility. We are a legal Brazilian entity, so we're comfortable with that.
So that makes sense for your company if you have a legally owned subsidiary there and as large as you are. And so with smaller companies, oftentimes we'll see that their contract isn't in English. And I guess that depends on the negotiating power that you have with the client. How are you selling internationally?
How? Today or just in general?
Well, that brings up a good another good question. Let's talk both.
Okay.
How do you typically sell? Because I'm surprised that you don't have translation on your website, because it seems like with the people who would drive, like you're negotiating at the upper level, but I would guess that the people who first get interested in your products would be at a lower level. Their English might not be as strong, but I'm guessing.
A lot of reasons for that, probably today none of them good. So I think being established in the global industry for so long, we are in a position today where we do have a lot of competition. A lot of that, really all of that competition, is foreign based. So continental Europe, China, of course, a few other places in the world, Brazil. So we want to have a situation that really forces interpersonal exchanges. So, and this really was my belief, probably today needs to be challenged some. I never wanted to put everything out on the web and not have a reason for that person to give us a call. So again, we want to have a personal conversation. We want to understand, in particular, we want to understand the business model of the customer. So, you know, several times on this chat, we've talked that we deal with pet food companies. Well, pet food today, when I first started, there was the pet food market. Mm-hmm. You had dry pet food and you had wet pet food. Mm-hmm. Today, it is so stratified, you know, hundreds of formulations. And I think that's one thing that I saw early on in starting to deal with the major multinationals, that, and honestly, the biggest, clearest lesson came from two clients in Egypt that really showed that it's the business model that matters, not the market that you're in, not the particular product, it's the business model. So
really,
let me give a quick example that really flipped the light switch for me. So aquaculture in Egypt, of course, aquaculture has been around, the growing of fish in pens has been around for eons, but commercially it really has risen and fallen over the years. But for some reason, right at the very beginning of the Arab Spring, whatever year that was, now I don't recall, but Egyptian commercial aquaculture really took off. So right in the midst again of the Arab Spring unrest, Winger had people going into Egypt. We were transacting business, installing equipment, helping companies start to produce fish food. That's the product that our equipment makes in that particular case. And then it wasn't long before Egyptian companies started coming to Sabetha, Kansas. And within a space of probably 2 weeks, we had one particular company come in, totally new to us. So we're spending time getting to know each other, asking about their business model, and the head person, or at least the one that could speak English, said, you know, and I'm paraphrasing, of course, but in essence, you know, we are the producer of a commodity. catfish feed, tilapia feed is a commodity. And because it's a commodity, pennies matter. So we don't want any of the bells and whistles. Give us, strip all that stuff off and just give us a tool. And so we did. Winger is known for all the bells and whistles and the things that add value, but we were able to strip everything down and we essentially gave them a hammer, let's say. And we concluded the deal and, you know, both parties felt great about it. A week later, literally their competitor from a few kilometers down the road was visiting Winger. And it was interesting that their head person said, you know, we're in a commodity business, tilapia feed. We need every bell and whistle that Winger can provide that will help save us pennies per ton. So two people within kilometers of each other competing in the same market, two totally different approaches, and really leaving that second meeting. You know, I started calling internal meetings, sales and service and process in particular, saying, you know, I know we have our product that we like to sell, but if we don't find out what their business model is and what their pain and pressure and opportunities are,
yeah,
we're wasting time, valuable time. And so that ties back into why we don't put much information on the web. We want people to see that we're an established, very well respected, hopefully well run, well managed company. And we want them to say, oh, I can't find what I need, but here's a contact. Let me give them a call. And we want to have the one-on-one conversations. So ours is a comparatively long sales cycle, a very engineered approach. We have standard pieces of equipment, but how we configure those equipment, the things that we attach to the equipment to affect functionality, that all specifically addresses the customer's needs and opportunities. So we spend a lot of time consulting with them, learning about them, learning about their formulation, learning about their marketing, how they sell, how they promote. And then we jointly together craft what that offer is over a matter of months. Sometimes that means coming to the Winger Technical Center, them coming and seeing equipment and running. Often it means us going to their facility. And I would say most sales projects from the first inquiry to equipment leaving the door, 18 to 24 months.
So you have a large sales force then?
We honestly used to have a larger sales force. When I first took over sales in whatever, early 90s, I think globally we had probably 25, 28 individuals. And today we are at 14. So some of that certainly has been the internet, email, the ease of communication, the speed of communication. And some of it is we have changed how we structured sales. We used to be very territory-based, and that salesperson would cover the entire Winger product line from ramen noodles or quick cooking rice to salmon feed, frog feed, eel feed, you know, just all those hundreds of things. And it stopped working. It just wasn't working as well as I thought it should. So we switched to a more of a division approach where we've got a companion animal division that focuses on all things pets and pet related. We've got a food and industrial division and then an aqua feed division. And so literally we may have a gentleman who lives in Indonesia, and because he's with the food division, let's say, and there is a pet food customer in Indonesia, we will send our pet food salesman from Taiwan. It's gotten so specialized that we really we were doing a disservice to ourselves and our clients by being such generalists. So we've switched, and I think that's been a big reason for our growth in sales as well.
So how has COVID shut down? Because it sounds like your sales process is very high touch.
Yep. It historically has been very high touch. One of the things that we have always said is that if it's a valid project, if their board, the customer prospect's board, is committed, and we get them to visit Sabetha, we think it's probably a 95%+ chance that we will win that business. Again, because of just the relationship and our capabilities, it's, you know, relationship is one thing, but if you can't back up that relationship with excellent service and excellent product and all of that, you're not going to go anywhere. So when COVID first hit, we really thought that, number one, we thought it would be a couple weeks, couple months. As things have drug on, we have adapted, I think, very well. We hit our sales targets for the year, despite not being able to travel. And some of that is really due to those relationships. Much of that is probably due to the fact that we have such high repeat business. And then the other contributing factor is just the long cycle. Admittedly, our first quarter sales were nowhere near target because everybody thought, well, we'll put it on hold for a little bit, the project on hold, and we'll get back together. Well, towards the end of the second quarter, really all of those projects that were in flux, all of those customers said, hey, you know, I don't know how we're going to do it, but let's jump on this funny Zoom thing and see if we can, because they want to move forward, we want to move forward. And we were able to close, you know, we were able to close and hit our targets. So that was really good. And again, because we're such a long cycle, not only on the sales side, but also on manufacturing, our 21 sales are booked through June. So and that's a good thing for us. It's a lead time, a manufacturing lead time from placement of order to X Works that our particular industry seems to accept. 6 months is kind of at the upper limit, admittedly. I wish we were more down in the 4 month. But some of that is just, we've been successful and we're busy and customers understand that. So I think some of just our long cycles helped pull us through a good chunk of the COVID shutdown, travel shutdown. Mm-hmm. But we're seeing new business come in, new prospects come in. And I think everybody has kind of, globally, it seems that everybody's kind of said, you know, we can do this by Zoom. And I don't have to spend whatever a full day flying, jet lag, and just all the things that we used to think were fun, I guess. I don't think we will see, we'll see some travel come back, probably more so in our service and maintenance groups. Sales, I honestly will be shocked if we get to 30% of what our travel.
Interesting. But you might miss some of those long dinners and connections.
That is the thing. So now we have to start looking at new ways. If people either can't or no longer will travel to Sabetha, how do we build those relationships? And that's something that we've got, I think, some good plans, but you can never truly replicate that. So that's going to be the tragedy in all of this.
Right.
It's just loss of relationship.
So, or redefining relationship. You know, how do you build a relationship on Zoom when we're all getting Zoom fatigue? But
yeah,
you know, it's interesting because I was talking to a client the other day. So and I'm seeing a transition with a lot of companies where it used. So if you think about the sales process, you've got awareness where somebody figures out they have a problem and they're trying to learn how to solve that problem to, you know, connect. They've more identified some possible solutions and how they dig through it to engage, which is they go through the buying process and now how do you keep them as a customer? So all through there, there's in your process, it's all high touch relationship and you've got a high end product. So that makes a lot of sense. I'm seeing some companies who are saying, and research is showing too, that younger people particularly are coming along saying, I don't want to talk to a salesperson till I'm most of the way down the sales process.
Right.
They're going online to get that information. So they want to hear about how other people have had problems. What are the possible solutions? What are the pros and cons to doing it? And then when it gets down, so they get more general education. And then when they come in, they're talking specifically. So I did talk to a client the other day who said by adding that information, they worked with an ad agency to add that information to their website. And then they translated it. They said they could see their close times shortening because the education was done online up front. Have you ever looked at that or thought about that? Because I hear what you're saying. There's that balance of then the competitors get the information and you don't have time to build that relationship. So I can see that conflict there.
Yeah. And it is, like I've said several times, that I probably need to be pushed or challenged in that area. This is a situation that's going to push me out of my comfort zone. But we are moving in that direction. So we will be doing much more video. Again, in our technical center, we've got the equipment installed and we're actually running plant proteins or industrial starch as a demo, typically for a customer. We are making, I think, a good pivot in that we've reinvested in that facility during this COVID year. We've all in, we'll probably have about a $20 million reinvestment in the technical center.
Wow.
Sizable. That's mainly infrastructure and equipment and processing and all that. But we do have a sizable investment into a media center. So I think we will very quickly in the coming months, we will be turning much more into a media focus than we are kind of a sales focus. I agree completely that the trend is moving towards gathering the customer, the prospect, gathering a lot of information, getting comfortable. We have always kind of done that in a way. We always brought in the process experts, not the salespeople, but many times in tandem. But our process experts are truly that. They are the world's leading experts in that particular process. Mm-hmm. Plant proteins, if you want to know about plant proteins, Winger's got the people that are leading that industry. So even our salesmen are happy to say, Brian, you know, here you go. And so we are going to be much more of a content creation sales method in the coming months where we're shooting video, we're taking the lab analysis. So, you know, we deal with cereal science all the time. So there's all kinds of chemistry tests and analysis that happen. So we'll be marrying video of the process running with the analytical results, with the Winger process expert talking through the test, the runs and all those results. And we'll be packaging that together. I hope.
Excellent.
Very
that sounds like good content.
And one thing that I think we need to talk about is foreign language subtitles or, you know, something else, because again, we're not going to be able to physically get there and work with an interpreter and gauge that cadence of English interpretation local language and back and forth. So I really think we have to make that hard pivot to content creation. I still probably won't post that on the web other than maybe some teasers. Again, I think it's just very vital that somehow we create that interaction. And if that interaction today is by Zoom, so be it. We want to be able to have that exchange and then say, tell you what, I'm going to follow up with a pack. You know, you can download a zip file and get more information, review that, form your questions, and then let's get back together on another Zoom. And we'll keep parsing all of this information down until you really have what you need.
Yes. Yeah. You can also put it up on your website so it's not really searchable, so somebody can't find it, but you can still send links so you can save some of that sending out, or you could do a controlled portal.
Yep.
Or a login site. So somebody who's a serious, you can give them a customized login and they can go in and access all of that.
Yeah.
Yeah. So many different ways. And I like your idea because you can do subtitles or voiceovers, but I think subtitles would be less expensive and I think it would be more appropriate for your users. So I'm glad to hear that you're doing that. There's a really good book called They Ask, You Answer by Margaret Sheridan. And it talks about the types of content that people look for.
Okay.
Yeah. So we are, this hour has flown by. So we're coming to the end and you've been so informative. Thank you. Thank you so much for sharing all. I always like to ask, what's your favorite foreign word?
Favorite foreign word. We acquired a company from in Denmark about 8 years ago. And we had clients in Denmark prior and Scandinavia. I just, that whole area I really enjoy. I've traveled too frequently. Mm-hmm. But again, just really through this acquisition, got to know the Danes. And they have a word that I will probably butcher, but it's hygge.
Oh, yeah.
And when I first, my new friends 8 years ago, again, over meals, that's the best time and place to understand someone else. We just kind of were exploring this culture. I really enjoyed the Danish culture and the food and all that.
I know what hygge means, but why don't you define it more for our listeners? Because I think it's such a good one for right now.
Yeah. Oh, for right now, especially. I don't know that there's necessarily a good English word. It's more of a feeling. Hygge is a feeling of contentment. And I would add to that, I think for me, that hygge sentimentality is much more of a rootedness or a grounding. And being content in that. So I would say that it's, it gets back to the American, I think, sentiment. Maybe it's a small town sentiment of you bloom where you're planted. So I think we have seen that in our small community. And certainly globalization and the internet and all of that has helped that tremendously, that bloom where you're planted. Figure out a way to do what you want to do and what you were called and created to do. And today you don't have to move to the coast or New York or LA to do those things. And that all ties in to me to that hygge sentimentality, that comfort and contentedness. And, the Danes would say hygge is, a warm fire in the fireplace and a hot drink and a blanket and you're with your family playing a board game. That's, and you're getting along. That's hygge, and we probably need that now more than ever.
Yes. Yes. So, that's so appropriate, is to do those things that create that special feeling of warmth inside, however you you define it. Yeah.
Social media and then constant 24/7 news are anti-Hygge.
Yes. Yes. So, politics anti-Hygge. Yeah. That's a good one. And I've never heard you bloom where you are planted.
You're planted.
That's a like a Kansas saying or farming, or you just always heard it?
I just always heard it. I don't. Maybe that's what my family taught, or I think it is maybe a small town. For some small towns, even if they grew up there, they can't wait to leave. And yeah, it's just how we're made. Other people probably just kind of go with the flow and shrug their shoulders, and other people say, "I'm going to go for it."
Yeah, I love that. I have my mantra right now that I have on a post-it on my desk is, "These are the good old days."
Yeah, so true.
I try to remind myself, celebrate every day. All right, so is your what was your favorite vacation?
Favorite vacation. I don't know that I could narrow it down. Growing up, I've got an older sister. My parents and I and us two kids, we got in the old Buick and drove up to Yellowstone, Jackson Hole area before Jackson Hole was movie stars and moguls and all that. Yeah. And that was a place where my grandparents, Lou and Tilly Winger, they liked to vacation. And so they were there at the same time, and we just had a grand time. I was in middle school. But then we also, parents and my sister and I, we went to Santa Fe, New Mexico every summer. We enjoy the being in our area, horses, cattle, all that. We enjoy cowboy, Western art, all of that, Southwest art. And then today we, as my wife and I and our kids, we either like to go to a place called Cloud Camp. It's a Broadmoor, Colorado property. Or North Captiva Island.
I've been there. That's fabulous.
Yeah. So we still like isolation. We live out in the country. Closest neighbor is a mile away, and I can't see their house. So that's where we like to go, to the same kinds of places for vacation.
Oh, good for you. So outside of the U.S., where's your favorite place to do business?
I think Thailand is fascinating as a culture, as a language, as a written language. Their art and their cultural aspects are just, I think they're very unique, maybe even more unique than other Asian cultures. So Thailand is a great place. I've never, unfortunately, made it to their resorts or, destinations. Everywhere I've traveled internationally has almost exclusively been for work. As a family, we've not traveled internationally.
Interesting. Yeah.
So for me, we're family focused here. And when in the pre-COVID days, and earlier in my career, I probably traveled internationally 10 to 15 days a month. And it was Europe, get home for a few days, go to Asia, home for a few days, go to South America. And it was just kind of a constant repeat. And as I've progressed through the company and we've expanded our skilled and professional people, a lot of those have taken that travel requirement off of me. So I don't travel as much internationally, certainly not today, but even pre-COVID, the last couple of years, I've probably only done 4 or 5 trips international. Most often those are to a key account somewhere. I think in my whole career, probably 38, 39 countries, different countries.
Wow.
Many of them have got dozens of trips.
Yeah.
But I always tell everybody that I have seen from my hotel window. I have seen the finest HVAC units the world has to offer. You know, I could, it doesn't matter where I'm at. I go open the window and my view is the HVAC.
That's funny. So, all right. So where can people reach you or find you if they have more questions?
They can find me at winger.com. That's our primary website. You can find me on LinkedIn. People misspell my name quite often. My parents thought that they would do an Americanized version of Leif, and it gets butchered much more than had they kept the whatever Norwegian spelling. So, find me, Leif Bailey, LinkedIn.
L-A-F-E, Leif, yep. Bailey, B-A-I-L-E-Y, on LinkedIn.
Yep.
You're probably the only Leif Bailey on there, right?
There, you know, I've never checked, but there are not many.
Yeah.
So probably good, good reason for that.
Good. Well, thank you so much for being on here today, Leif. It's so wonderful to hear about the success you've had with growing Wenger Manufacturing and how you value relationships and how that's made you successful. I certainly feel that way about getting to know you.
It's been fun.
Yeah.
That's been fun. So I hope the audience gets something out of it, get some questions, and I hope they found it worth their time.
I'm sure they will. I hope some manufacturers listen and realize how accessible it is to do international business with the support that you get. So thank you, listeners. I appreciate if you give us a recommendation and share this with a manufacturer you know or somebody who's in the center of the United States that might be thinking about or has the capabilities of exporting. And we'll catch up with you next time on the next episode. Thank you.
That's a wrap for this session. A big thanks to you for listening to the Global Marketing Show. Hope you had just as much fun as I did. New sessions launch weekly on all places you find podcasts, Apple, Spotify, Google Play, and of course on our website. If you know someone interested in this topic, please tell them about us. Au revoir for now.